got a right to live. Everybody's got a right to live. And before this campaign fails, we'll all go down to jail. 'Cause everybody's got a right to live.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. That is music from a rally at First United Methodist Church in Madison following Saturday's march on the state capitol coordinated by the Poor People's Campaign. That's a national call to action in dozens of states to focus on people impacted by poverty and injustice. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Petter Johansson is Outreach Development Coordinator for Triangle Community Ministry in Madison and co-chair for Faith and Moral Outreach with the Wisconsin Poor People's Campaign. Petter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me and thanks for sharing our story.
Yes, and we also have Reverend Liz Theo Harris, a Milwaukee native and executive director of the Kairos Center for Religions, Rights, and Social Justice at Union Theological Seminary in New York, also co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Reverend Theo Harris, welcome to the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you, Kate.
Well, let's start with you as you spearhead the nationwide effort, Poor People's Campaign, holding events before 30 state houses, including our state capitol in Madison. What is your message you are trying to deliver to state lawmakers?
Well, poverty is the fourth largest cause of death in this United States of America, one of the richest countries in the history of the world. And right now we're in an election season, we're in congressional seasons, and yet the word poverty or the word poor and the issues of low wages and healthcare, our failing education system, and so many different programs that need to be there to lift the load of poverty are either being cut or already have been eliminated. And so what we're trying to say is that poverty has to be at the forefront of our political agenda and our political landscape, that it's immoral and wrong to have 135 million people in the United States, more than 2 million in Wisconsin, who are poor or one emergency away from absolute economic ruin. When we have the wherewithal, when we have the policy ideas, when we have the resources to actually abolish poverty. And so we have to abolish poverty being one of the leading causes of death, and we have to put it at the center of our political landscape, including in this election season right now.
I think what you're describing and the words that are sometimes attached to this campaign is that it's calling for a moral revival. Can you talk more about what morals need greater priorities? What morals need to be uplifted in this nation?
Well, thanks for this, because this is exactly this is exactly the point. Right now, the real moral and constitutional values that need to be in the forefront of our nation are expanding healthcare, are lifting from the bottom so that everybody can rise. You know, letting families be able to thrive and not just barely survive. I mean, the issues that our faith traditions and our Constitution speak to are about freedom and democracy and justice for all. And so we're talking about the fact that we need a moral revival. You know, for too long now, people have been relegated to a position of not having dignity in work, not being able to have the food that they need for their families, not having an adequate place, a roof over their heads. And this is wrong. This is wrong in the kind of history of our country. This is wrong to our different faith traditions. You know, I'm a Christian pastor. This is the season of Lent. Lent is about turning away from injustice. It's about fasting from inequality. And so we need a kind of moral revival that will, reach back into those great, values of love and truth and justice. And the idea that we can indeed address systemic racism, abolish poverty, and be able to save the earth and everything that's living in and on it.
Petter, you were at the Wisconsin Poor People's Campaign March and Rally in Madison Saturday. What issues in the campaign are percolating, are most relevant to Wisconsin voters?
Yeah, we had a great day on Saturday, really good turnout. And, you know, one of the things that I love about this movement, it's a moral fusion movement. And what we mean is it includes everybody. It includes all these issues. Reverend Theo Harris mentioned a little bit about this, that, you know, the people that are impacted by poverty are dealing with all sorts of issues and all sorts of problems. And these are things that can be fixed with policy. And so we had people showing up talking about women's rights. We have people showing up talking about healthcare and voting access and all of these issues that are affecting individuals and families that are living in poverty. I think as far as Wisconsin goes, healthcare is a big issue. I know this is a big issue nationwide, but particularly with Medicaid. You know, Wisconsin is one of the only states left in the country that has yet to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. We leave millions of dollars, federal funds, on the table every year when our legislature refuses to expand Medicaid. And they seem to be doing it purely for partisan and political reasons. 70% of Wisconsinites that have been polled on this want to see Medicaid expanded, and yet it just continues to languish in the state house. And so we're really pushing hard on that. You know, and when we saw during the pandemic, we had these programs that, you know, expanded Medicaid in some ways. It expanded some of the programs that help people with housing and with food. And we saw poverty decline. People were lifted out of poverty, including children. And when we declared that the pandemic was over and the funding ran out for those programs and we started to close those things out, we've seen people fall back into poverty. 17 million people across the country have been disenrolled from Medicaid since the unwinding. And 70% of those are for procedural reasons. They would still qualify. Here in Wisconsin, that's 268,000 people have been disenrolled from Medicaid. And roughly 4 in 10 of them, as far as states that break this down by age, 4 out of 10 of these people disenrolled are children. And so this is really a big issue. It impacts everybody. I think everybody, regardless of their economic status, understand that access to healthcare is a real problem and the way that it is covered and paid for. So we're fighting hard for that. Voting rights is a big issue as well. Wisconsin used to rank very high in access to voting. I think we're currently 47th by some measures, 47th in the nation as far as having access to voting. And so we're pushing hard for that as well.
That is Petter Johansson, co-chair for Faith and Moral Outreach with the Wisconsin Poor People's Campaign. We also have Reverend Liz Theo Harris, who is a Milwaukee native, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A multi-state social justice movement seeks to call attention to the poverty crisis. The Poor People's Campaign delivers a policy agenda at state houses across the country, including Madison. Co-chair Reverend William Barber says the campaign is launching its largest voter mobilization in history.
We're not beating up on poor low-wage folk because the number one reason they say they don't vote is nobody talks to them, and that's true. But what we're saying is if they won't talk to you, it's time to make them hear you.
Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Reverend Liz Theo Harris is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Petter Johansson is a faith organizer with Wisconsin's movement. Reverend Liz, the Poor People's Campaign is trying to mobilize millions of poor and low-wage workers ahead of November, and the campaign says turnout among these voters is typically 20-22% below average voter turnout. What would help more people and help more low-income people vote?
Well, Kate, you know, there's almost 2 million poor and low-income voters in Wisconsin, 39% of the electorate, right? I mean, that's a huge block of people. And yet, as you said, folks tend to vote at a lower rate than higher income voters because we don't hear the issues that, you know, impact us the most. The candidates are not putting forward their proposals for living wages and for healthcare and for, you know, better funding for our schools. In fact, somehow almost the word poor has almost become a four-letter word in our political vocabulary. So if and when candidates start talking about these issues and the kind of policy solutions that exist to actually lift the load of poverty and address the issues, what we have seen is that people do tend to come out and participate in elections at a higher level. And if poor and low-income voters were to vote at similar rates to higher income voters, we could, you know, sway election outcomes in every state. We could shift the entire political landscape. And so we are reaching out to millions of poor and low income, what they call low propensity voters, folks that are less likely to vote, you know, there's because of voter suppression, because of the lack of transportation, because of other kind of barriers to voting that particularly impact poor and low-income people, but also because we're not hearing the issues, that we're not having politicians kind of call our name, and poor and low-income people are seeing the things that they need to see to understand that we can all have an impact on this democracy, and mm-hmm. and indeed we can elect politicians that are interested in passing policies that help you know, your average person, including poor and low income people. And so, you know, we're doing that kind of outreach. We launched on Saturday, you know, this most recent 40 weeks of reaching out to people and mobilizing and organizing and registering and educating people for a movement that votes around issues like healthcare, like living wages. You know, we say in our work that our votes they're not just support, they're demands. They're demands for the kind of issues that could lift the load of poverty.
Petter, I want to make a connection as we heard Reverend Barber there in saying that they don't listen to you, they don't talk to you, and that has a connection with that voter apathy. And I just want to ask you about the invisibility of poverty and how that blends into the political sphere and influence. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, that is a really good question. And you raise a really important issue. I work with a nonprofit that serves the Triangle neighborhood in Madison, Wisconsin. It's the second largest subsidized housing development in the state. And it's so interesting. It's right between South Park, Regent, and Washington. So if people familiar with Madison know exactly where that is. And yet, even in Madison, people are unaware that there's a neighborhood back there and that there are people living there. And so it really, that invisibility is very real, for sure. You know, folks that don't have to deal with the issues of poverty can live their lives happily and be unaware of just how challenging life is. In my neighborhood, especially, there's a lot of folks that are dealing with disability. A lot of folks are dealing with mental illness and other challenges that simply get in the way of thriving in their life. And that apathy is real. You know, a lot of the folks that I know there, they do pay attention to politics. They are engaged as voters. But then when we talk about candidates, sometimes there is apathy because they don't hear their challenges talked about and they don't hear their issues talked about. And Reverend Theo Harris mentioned that, right? That we don't hear enough about poverty and the poor when we hear our politicians talk. You know, this is 40% almost of our electorate and they're often ignored. And so candidates need to do a better job. And we'll work with anybody. You know, we're not a partisan organization. We'll work with any side of the aisle that wants to lift these things up. And we believe that these are moral issues that should apply to all of us and that we should all care about. So it's not about right or left. It's about right or wrong.
Petter, it makes me wonder, as you spent more than a decade as a pastor, also here we are with Reverend Theo Harris, what role does religion have in this moral issue of the poverty crisis?
For sure. I'm also a Christian pastor, and so I come from the same tradition as Reverend Theo Harris. But, you know, across the board, I mean, most of the world, well, all of the world's major religions, poverty is a central issue. Caring for the poor, caring for the vulnerable, standing with those who are marginalized and oppressed, standing in solidarity and being part of making this world better. You know, that's at the core of who we are as people of faith. And so, yeah, for those years in the pulpit, I would bring this up often and just remind our community that this is who we are. And this, we don't really have an option. This is what we have to care about, right? This is the promise that has claimed us and the promise that we have made as people of faith, as God's community in the world. And so it really should be a driving factor for all of the decisions that we make and all the actions that we take as a community of faith, and something that we should be talking about.
We are talking about the Poor People's Campaign. You can call in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Reverend Theo Harris, what role do you think can faith leaders and congregations have in addressing this poverty crisis?
Well, when we look at history and we look today, you know, congregations, religious congregations are at the forefront of both meeting the needs of people when they are down on their luck or unable to afford the necessities of life, but also at the forefront of movements for change. You know, when we think about something like the March on Washington in 1963, you know, there were tens of thousands of people of faith and from congregations that were there, you know, talking about jobs and freedom. I mean, that's what that was focused on. And even in less visible places, you know, whenever there are movements for justice. And yet somehow over the last decades, as extremists have kind of hijacked some forms of religions, including Christianity, all of a sudden it's that the real moral issues of our day are about who can marry who, and the idea that Jesus was a you know, card-carrying member of the NRA, and not that Jesus traveled around the countryside, you know, setting up free healthcare clinics, never charging a leper a copay. And so I think that, you know, so often what we're seeing, including in the Poor People's Campaign work across the country, you know, we had folks, as you said, in more than 32 states across the country in state capitals this past Saturday, you know, raising this issue that poverty equals death. And there were faith leaders and congregations that were mobilized in every one of those, and people across different religious traditions saying, you know, this is not the nation we want to live in. You know, this is not who our religious traditions teach us to be. You know, we indeed should, you know, follow, you know, religious teachings that say that we should lift the load of poverty, that we should lift from the bottom so everyone rises. We should cancel debt. We should pay workers what they deserve. We should make sure that actually the abundance of the world is able to reach every human being in the world. And so it's amazing to see the kind of faith leaders. Sometimes you don't hear about this as much, but there are congregations and faith leaders out there all the time, you know, both meeting those needs, but also calling our society to account about, you know, actually abolishing injustice and abolishing poverty.
Your words also, you know, bring me closer to that history of the civil rights era. It also makes me reflect on how, you know, President Lyndon Johnson launched the War on Poverty way back in the 1960s to, you know, eliminate poverty in America. And then here we are, our nation still grappling with this and why such a wealthy nation, we can't accomplish this elimination of poverty. Petter, do you grapple with that?
Absolutely. And I just keep coming back to this is a choice. You know, that's the reason why poverty still persists, because those in power, those who are making these policy decisions, are choosing for it to be this way. These systems are not broken. This is how the systems are designed. I mean, we're seeing that with a Medicaid disenrollment. It is designed to get people off of Medicaid. They're trying to make it challenging for people who need help to get the help that they need. And we have so much wealth, so many resources in this country. We can abolish poverty. We just need to have the will to do it. These policies that are keeping people poor, it's a form of violence and it needs to stop.
Well, Petter and Reverend Liz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Reverend Liz Theo Harris is a Milwaukee native, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. Petter Johansson is co-chair for Faith and Moral Outreach with the Wisconsin Poor People's Campaign. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about efforts underway at a correctional facility in Milwaukee to help rehabilitate offenders and support families involved in the criminal justice system. But first, President Joe Biden delivers his State of the Union address tonight, roughly 8 months before the November election. It comes as the president and his administration have been promoting Biden's record in swing states like Wisconsin. WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk visited the White House and has this report.
In Washington, D.C. earlier this week, a wide range of advisors to President Joe Biden met with reporters to highlight their boss's first-term accomplishments, and they got wonky.
First of its kind, corporate minimum tax.
And under this administration, Medicare is finally at the negotiating table.
60,000 farms, 25 million acres enlisted in climate smart agriculture practices.
That was Daniel Hornung of the National Economic Council, Kristen Link Young of the Domestic Policy Council, and Ali Zaidi, National Climate Advisor. Their message was consistent. Biden is delivering material successes for your community. Stephen Benjamin is the White House Director of Public Engagement.
Our job here at the White House is just believing that good governance is good policy and good politics. So we'll keep doing our jobs and doing it well here.
That approach has been on display in Wisconsin, where the Biden administration has made repeated visits. On Sunday, First Lady Jill Biden was in Waukesha. And yesterday, Vice President Kamala Harris was in Madison to announce an apprenticeship program. She spoke from a construction site for a new bus maintenance facility the Biden administration helped pay to build.
This work that we see behind us is a function of that partnership around how we can get federal dollars out to local governments and local communities.
Last month, Biden himself was in northern Wisconsin to celebrate federal funding for the Blotnick Bridge between Duluth and Superior. His team even produced a short documentary about the project.
Where Duluth and Superior meet represents a key transportation hub in the Great Lakes region where all of the important pieces come together.
These visits underscore a key part of Biden's campaign message. Things like bridges and broadband are a hint of what's to come in his re-election campaign against former President Donald Trump. Anthony Chergosky is a political scientist at UW-La Crosse. He says these kitchen table issues could be a tough sell for Biden at a time when many voters are concerned about high costs. But Chergosky understands why the White House is making the pitch.
Because if that even moves a few voters, that could quite literally be the difference in Wisconsin, and winning Wisconsin could quite literally be the decisive factor in who becomes president.
But veteran Republican operative Mark Grawl says that kind of a campaign likely won't work in this election, a race that pits two very well-known personalities against each other for a second time.
Because so many people have already made up their mind on both former President Trump and current President Biden that I really don't know that that kind of stuff is going to move the needle.
And Wisconsin's GOP congressional delegation has its own pitch on Biden's record. Janesville Republican Brian Stiles says the policies Biden is touting are the reason people should vote against him.
When you have this massive amount of spending coming out of Washington as this administration is overseeing, what you do is you overstimulate the economy, you drive inflation, and you make things less affordable for families in Wisconsin.
That's a starkly different vision of America than the one being painted back at the White House. Public engagement director Stephen Benjamin said he thinks Americans are beginning to feel a shift in economic headwinds.
And hopefully and prayerfully, people will get, will feel the benefits in their lives every day and also attribute them directly to the leadership of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris.
It's a message Democrats continue to drive home in Wisconsin and one that Biden will focus on again in his State of the Union address tonight. But in a hyper-partisan election year, the question is whether voters are listening. For Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And for more conversation ahead of tonight's State of the Union address, join Central Time at 4 this afternoon. WPR's Anya Van Wagtendonk joins the program to share more of her reporting from Washington. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center offers in-person family visits after years without them. We discuss recent efforts to build up social connections and change the culture inside an incarceration facility. Call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Jewell has been superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center since 2020. Chantel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate, and everyone listening. Thank you for having me.
Yes, let's start with family visits. Reinstating these visits, from what I understand, they were discontinued nearly a decade ago. Why is it important to allow these visits to happen again?
This has been one of my top priorities since I came into my role as superintendent. And it comes down to two things. One of our core values is humanity. And so it's bringing humanity back to our work and helping to keep families connected. But also evidence supports family visitations in correctional facilities. This is a way to help individuals stay connected to their families. When someone becomes incarcerated, they aren't the only people impacted. Mm-hmm. Their families are also impacted. But it's also beneficial to help them to continue to build their support system because, especially in our case, most of these individuals will be released back to the community.
From what I understand, there are about 1,000 people housed at the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. Can you describe what are visitations like at the center?
So right now, we have two methods of visitation. One of the things that I'm most proud of that we also did was we opened up a family visitation center where in-person visitation occurs between a co-parent and a child. Hmm. We want to help to continue to build those social bonds between parents and children during the incarceration period. So we were lucky enough to receive a grant, and we were able to build out or repurpose some space within the interior of our facility where we could allow those visits to occur. And so we've been able to do that. But also we opened up what was historically known as our visitation center. And those are not contact visits. Those are visits through a window, mm-hmm. but it's still provides a way for individuals to stay connected.
Chantel, doesn't inmates' outlook or attitude change after these family visitations? I mean, are there differences you've observed in this short period since restarting them?
Yes, and as a tenured correctional professional, I can speak to the significance of these visits. You see behavioral changes. People don't want to lose their visits. You know, for people that suffer with mental health conditions, a visit can make a world of difference. People who are having tough days, it shifts the atmosphere in our facility.
Is there a waiting list at all for family visits?
There is not currently a waiting list.
So how do social connections actually make a shift, make a difference in the facility and in people's lives?
Well, things seem to calm down more. One other thing we did in Milwaukee County, and the county exec put in his budget this year, again, to help families stay connected, is we added free phone calls and free video visitation. So each of our residents will get 390 minutes of free phone calls and 60 minutes of free video visitation per month. And just that ability to stay connected to a loved one. Loved ones have more influence. They can help individuals stay motivated to participate in programming, to make positive changes, to not engage in fights because they don't want to lose privileges. They want to stay connected to their family. They want to be able to visit. And they're able to share the positive things that they are doing. They are able to build reentry plans so that they have a stable place to come to upon release. And so all of that's helpful. But when individuals aren't able to visit or stay connected, there's a breakdown. And we know how important support is upon reentry.
It all requires communication.
It can be the difference of somebody being successful or not successful.
Yes.
And reengaging the criminal justice system.
I mean, what you're talking about really requires some deep planning and conversations. And without those connections, that can be very difficult. You know, the center used to be called House of Correction. And then last year, you and Milwaukee County Executive David Crawley changed the name to the Community Reintegration Center. Why does the name change matter?
We wanted a name to reflect our true mission and vision. When you think of a name such as the House of Correction, it seems harsh, punitive, antiquated, and it's just not reflective of who we are. And what I mean when I say that, individuals, the punishment is actually being sent to our facility. We're not there to punish. We're there to help people become better and return to our community better than when they left, and to address whatever causes brought them into contact with the criminal justice system. And I believe that is how we're going to create safer communities throughout Milwaukee County and throughout Wisconsin.
Chantel Jewell is with us, superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. It's located in Franklin. Be part of this conversation. You can call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A state corrections department dashboard monitors trends in reoffending. Of the more than 8,000 people released from Wisconsin state facilities in 2019, more than half were rearrested within 3 years. We explore the latest efforts by one county facility to help incarcerated people return to their communities and not re-enter the criminal justice system. We have the superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, Chantel Jewell, and you can call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel, what common problems are people incarcerated at the center grappling with? What is happening in their lives?
Well, there are a lot of unstable housing situations. You'll see a lot of people with mental health conditions, substance use disorders, we'll find those type of issues amongst our resident population.
How do you approach the mental health piece? Because being in a facility would, you know, probably make those conditions, make the situation worse.
So, Kay, our facility is a little different than most jails. We are statutorily a house of correction. And so we were established primarily for rehabilitation and to get people back to work. And our facility is a lot calmer. We don't have cells. We have a dormitory style housing. We have mental health professionals to come in and work with individuals. For those individuals that struggle in the general population, we have special housing for them with a reduced population size, staff that are trained differently to respond to that population. And so we really try to address the needs of those individuals while they are in our care.
Can you talk about the skill building that is happening and people at the center being able to get training in the trades?
Absolutely. So everything we do, all of our program is evidence-based. And so we focus on, again, the needs that brought individuals into the facility. And so the evidence also tells us, in addition to addressing that family dysfunction, that employment is a driver of criminal behavior. And if we address those employment issues and those education issues, that we can, in fact, reduce recidivism. And so this year, I'm happy that we were able to build a welding lab and open up a welding lab. I think they had a welding lab about 10 years ago or so, but we no longer had it in the facility. So we opened one. Individuals are able to earn industry recognized credentials in our facility, leave with a credential, ready for vocational employment. We have an employment navigator that works actually in our facility who is employed by the workforce board. So she is tied to all of those other resources in the community. She works with our resident population while they're in the facility, as well as meet them on the other side upon release. We have established partnerships with with community organizations like the Milwaukee Bucks, who will hire our individuals while they're incarcerated. And then they have a job post-incarceration. And if you will, I'd like to share a story about one of our residents.
Please do.
A success story. We'll just call him David. Mm-hmm. David was sentenced for recklessly endangering safety. There was an argument, fire shot in the air. Here or at the CRC, he had a chance to think about life. He took advantage of many classes, got a job with the Milwaukee Bucks, got OSHA safety training, also became employed with the City of Milwaukee Housing Authority, and today makes $70,000 a year. Mm. Now he can support his kids and family. He also took financial literacy and wellness classes at CRC. He's working towards buying a home. So we're going to meet individuals where they are. We're going to address their needs and provide programming that's uniquely catered for whatever their needs are. And it's all going to be wrapped around evidence-based programming.
Chantel Jewell is with us, superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, as we talk about the transition of people who are incarcerated back into the communities. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Alice in Madison is here. Alice, go ahead.
Yes, I just want to say thank you so much for bringing up the issue of how the family is involved in this as a whole.
The stigma and marginalization of families can make it very, very difficult to even assist their person in transitioning. And I think this is such an important issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Alice. Can you speak more to that about stigma and marginalization, and especially what these families on the outside are experiencing?
Okay, are you asking
me? Oh, yes, Chantel. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, oftentimes you have to remember in corrections, or as the correctional professional, our focus has historically been on the resident, or what we used to call the offender. Mm-hmm. And so the family piece wasn't as, we didn't engage in families as often as we probably should have. But now we have research that says family dysfunction is a leading driver of recidivism. We must engage families. And actually, families are going to be the people that are going to have more influence. So when we're able to connect with those family, those positive family members and loved ones and support systems, I believe we're going to have better outcomes, which is also why, since I've been there, I've created another position. It's a family outreach specialist. For this reason, that person is the liaison between our facility and the families. If the families have questions or concerns, that is who they can call to get those types, get the information they need or questions answered. Mm.
Before we have to go here, I want to quick ask you, your center has reduced its employee vacancy rate significantly. Can you talk just briefly about that and how you've been able to beat this trend on recruiting and retaining staff?
Yes, we were able to reduce our vacancy rate during the height of COVID. It was around 40%. We had a 40% vacancy rate. And today we're right around 11%. And I believe that the rebuild, the rebrand, and the name change was helpful in that, and helping people look at corrections differently and really what we can do, what we do in corrections, and that negative stigma, or that what a jailer is or what jail is about, help to change our name change and our rebrand, help to change some of that perspective. We're actually here to help people. Mm-hmm. And I think we were able to attract some people who traditionally would not have considered corrections as a career.
Chantel, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. And Kate, we're still hiring.
Thank you for inserting that. Chantel Jewell, Superintendent of the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. That is located in Franklin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to Sandy in Lake Geneva, who wants to make space to explore the lives of adults with autism. Also, Kylie in Sparta reached out seeking a program about autism as well. We learn about advances in research and supportive services for people with developmental disabilities. And you can call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Madeline Barger is a therapist and lead behavior analyst with the Waisman Center Autism Treatment Programs. Madeline, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and Megan Farley, your colleague, is here as well, psychologist, part of a team at the UW-Madison Waisman Center studying aging in autistic adults. Megan, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, Megan, let's start with you. As you examine aging and autism, what are the central research questions your group is asking?
Well, the thrust of this research project is to understand the natural course of autism throughout the lifespan into old age. And so We have an opportunity under the leadership of Janet Leinhart, who's a physician, a psychiatrist, and a wonderful researcher, to collect a huge amount of data from over 500 adults in three states who have autism. And so the real primary questions are about health and cognition, like dementia, heart health, and indicators that we can identify that will help predict the course for different individuals. So just really trying to understand how people age, what we can do to help them have, you know, the most successful lives possible. And in addition to those health measures, we're collecting a huge amount of data on a variety of other topics, including the characteristics of autism that the person exhibits, and then aspects of just their daily life and, you know, how they function and their quality of life and things like that.
Are there gaps in this understanding? I mean, is the research looking into the needs and the lifespan of autism? Are there missing pieces?
Oh, goodness, yes, yes. This is really groundbreaking research, unfortunately. I mean, folks with autism have been around for forever, but it's only been in the last 15 years or so that a lot of resources have gone into understanding how people with autism live and age into adulthood. And so you may be aware that research moves at a snail's pace compared to the course of actual life. So it's taking time to collect information that we can feel we can rely on to make decisions. And then it gets into people creating programs and policy development and finding what works and what doesn't work. So it's a slow moving thing. Meanwhile, people are living their lives. So the result is that we do have huge gaps. People with autism are grabbing the bull by the horns and creating their own communities. And they have been doing this online and supporting one another and doing a wonderful job with that. And then there are people, I work in private practice in the community. Madeline does a ton of work related to adults with autism. We have another colleague, Scott Allen, in the area who does a huge amount of work. So there are other people as well. And so there are not a lot of people, but a small number of people that are working really hard to try to build services and have better opportunities for people from the neurotypical perspective. Mm-hmm. Individuals with autism are doing their own thing. And then we're also working hard to try to provide support for them.
Yeah, thank you for that. And it really, it also makes you think about how the more the research is there, the more understanding, Madeline, of what services and support systems would be really helpful. Can you mm-hmm. talk about your work?
So this is sort of the other side of the coin with what Megan's talking about is sort of applying the application of this type of research. So I often work with, so I work, I don't have an age limit, which is kind of rare in the autism world. I work with teens and adults all the way through the lifespan. And what I'm seeing is that services drop off after early childhood to school age. And so a lot of my work, I work with individuals, couples, and families, and we look at how can we adapt the environment to fit different neurology. And how can we sort of build relationships that will sustain people? Having challenges with intimacy or long-term relationships has a significant impact on mental health, and it's hard to sort of get out into the world and access those things for all the reasons Megan's talking about, all the gaps in sort of services and care. So a lot of the work that I do is also training clinicians, because we can sort of have a deep understanding and direct sort of relationship with a lot of adults on the spectrum. But if they don't have anywhere to go, that's really tricky. So we're doing a lot of trying to train really skilled mental health clinicians to work with different neurology, which means adapting some of the methodology we might use in therapy. We adapt it for different brains and different learners. And it's hugely important to be able to do that, because otherwise we aren't able to apply all the things we're learning in research.
Madeline Barger there, a therapist and lead behavior analyst at the Weizmann Center. We have Megan Farley, who is a psychologist researcher studying aging and autism. You can join in questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. And Madeline, what does care look like for neurodivergent people in Wisconsin across different age ranges when maybe services are thin in specific areas or outside of metro areas?
Yeah, so as I had mentioned, there are more choices for early intervention, which could be more intensive or comprehensive treatment. So when somebody gets to middle school or high school, there are fewer choices. So there are autism clinics where they provide focused support. But what we're finding in mental health treatment is that we need to be, as Megan alluded to also, we need to be asking, not assuming. We have to ask the consumer. We have to ask the people who we're serving what they need. So a lot of adults on the spectrum are telling us that they need, just like all of us, relationships, reliable mental health support, support in the community or at work, and not necessarily a focus on maybe not focusing on skill deficit, but focusing on strength and thinking about how can we change the world and the environment to make this person more comfortable rather than always focusing on changing a person. So I think that's the big need is just support.
And Megan, in the research, I wonder as well, how important are the family caregivers who have been there through the lifespan, who have the knowledge of that loved one and caring for perhaps them as a child and now they're an adult? What do you see from the family caregivers through the research?
Family caregivers are tremendously important. We can't do the research without them. They really are oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes sort of the interpreter for the person between the troubleshooter, the problem solver. And that's true for many of us, but it's sort of more so with autism, where the person really understands the individual with autism very well and is able to help describe things in terms for us as researchers that allow us to sort of collate the information and make it very meaningful. Individuals with autism can do this too, but it's really important to work with somebody who understands the person intimately and has known them for years and years. And that's also true when you're doing diagnostic work with somebody who has a neurodevelopmental difference. So if it's autism or ADHD or something like that, it's really important and valuable to get information from somebody else that knows the person well and is able to answer a lot of questions about what they do that might be different than what's typical of other people. And then caregivers are just essential supports to people throughout the lifespan as well.
Psychologist Megan Farley focuses on adult diagnostics and research at UW-Madison's Waisman Center. Madeline Barger is here, therapist and lead behavior analyst with the Waisman Center Autism Treatment Programs. Call in with a question, share insights, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks to our listener requests, we explore new developments in supportive services for adults with disabilities. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have psychologist Megan Farley, part of a research team studying aging and autism at UW-Madison's Waisman Center, and Madeline Barger, her colleague, lead behavior analyst with the Waisman Center Autism Treatment Program and a clinic lead for teens and adults. Madeline, you're a licensed marriage and family therapist as well as a certified sex therapist. So how do those areas intersect with the work you do on the autism treatment program?
Yeah, so the intersection, so a huge part of quality of life for all of us is our relationships, our sex lives, our love lives, and our intimacy. And so what I do is I've adapted a lot of the family therapy and the sex therapy literature and research over the years to be inclusive for people on the spectrum. And there is a lot of benefit, as Megan alluded to before the break, to working with the whole family. So someone on the spectrum developmentally, they may be at home longer with their parents, but in clinical work, we still believe that they are entitled to sexual pleasure and happiness and also partnership. So we work with the whole family per Megan's research to make sure that everybody is on board and understanding what that might look like. And oftentimes we have debunked a lot of myths about sex and mm-hmm. relationships and autism.
What is the one that comes up? is there one that rises more than others that you hear more often?
Yeah. So a lot of times we'll hear that a person on the spectrum, a myth might be that they wouldn't be an understanding or empathic partner, which is simply not true. Mm-hmm. They're some of the most empathic people you could meet and have different and unique ways of expressing that. Incredible partners to their loved ones. So.
Well, this may or may not be a myth, but is it difficult or more difficult for neurodivergent people to make friends but also grow into intimate relationships?
Certainly, they will share that it's very difficult because a lot of the education from little on and is set up for maybe more neurotypical thinking in terms of how to make friends and sustain relationships. So we do a lot of sort of backtracking and begin sex education sometimes with adults, but adapted to their needs so that they can really understand what it is that they want and need and how to get that.
Let's bring on a call. Now, Carla is here in Fort Atkinson. Carla, hi.
Hi. I just want to do a huge shout out to St. Coletta School here in Jefferson County. My stepson is autistic, and he goes to school there. You know, once the kids leave their high school atmosphere, it's like, what do we do with our children now? And St. Coletta was a big help for us. Andy goes to programming 3 times a week. They pick him up right at the house, and we never have to worry about him there.
Thank you so much, Carla, for sharing that. Megan Farley, you know, looking at that transition from school to adulthood and bringing up their St. Coletta in Jefferson County, what comes up for you?
Well, it always occurs to me that it comes down to the human beings that are involved in someone's life. So there are a lot of really wonderful programs, and it's so great to hear about St. Coletta. I was just making a note of that because people are always asking me, where's a great program? But it does come down to the human beings that are working with someone. So there are some school programs that are fantastic. And, you know, I'd love to go there myself. And then there are programs that are staffed by people who maybe aren't as passionate or don't know as much about a condition or aren't willing to learn. You know, we know how this goes. So it just varies based on where you live and who the humans are that are going to be involved. And the same thing is true for rural and urban areas. There are pluses and minuses in both places. When I was a faculty in Utah, we did a research study on aging and autism, and it was a terrific study, and learned that many of the people that were living in rural areas have very robust lives, robust social lives. And I think a lot of the benefit for them came from just really being included in the community and accepted like anybody else would be, given the size of the community and the people there. And then people who are living in urban areas tend to have access to more sort of formal programming. So I think there's a wide variety in the experiences people have, and it comes down to the human beings involved in most cases.
We're talking about neurodiversity on the lifespan with UW-Madison's Waisman Center, Megan Farley, psychologist, Madeline Barger, therapist. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Rich in Milwaukee is here. Rich, hello.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I'm just trying to find some resources. I have a niece who has autism who lives in Juliet, Illinois, and she's 18, and the parents are struggling with resources to find help with, you know, they're getting older and she's getting older, and they're looking for places that she could possibly live at in the future or work at, you know, just resources. And it's real struggle to find anything. I didn't know if you knew of anything in the Juliet area.
Rich, thank you. Madeline, when you hear this type of story, what do you think about it in this scenario?
Yeah, I hear this often. I think often what we think about is the amount of training that we need to be doing as researchers and clinicians so that we can sort of grow that capacity in our region. Different university centers, I know, like the Weissman Center, have resource centers where you can call, and they're, you know, working diligently to expand the resources for adults. And so I'm less familiar with Illinois, but it would be really a good idea to contact a university center in the state and or a university and check out resources that way. Because sometimes they just haven't trickled out to the community.
Rich, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Scott in Madison, who is known to Megan and Madeline. Scott, I understand you're also with the Weissman Center.
Well, actually, I'm not with the Weissman Center.
Oh, okay.
I'm with LifeStance Madison, but I am a mental health counselor. I'm on the autism spectrum myself, and I work primarily with fellow autistic adults. And yes, I do consider myself a friend and colleague of Megan and Madeline. And what I wanted to add, in some ways echo some things that have been mentioned, but I want to expand on some of these ideas in terms of, so in my work as a counselor, when I have autistic adults come to me, many of them have had disappointing or even quite negative experiences with prior psychotherapy. And the single most frequent complaint that I hear is that other therapists either aren't equipped for or will not work with them on social skills. Mm. And this is, of course, significant because that's one of the main aspects of being autistic. And therefore, that's unsupported. There's not enough training. There's not enough understanding across most therapy options. You know, there are a few people here and there like myself, Megan and Madeline have this understanding, but it's not enough. And what this underscores to me is that autistic adults and people of various other neurodiverse backgrounds, they want connection. They want the social connection, the emotional connection with other people. But the fact is that society around them is still ignorant and often stigmatizing to them and their experiences. So the equation is skewed. You can teach and support the autistic individual, but they still have to live in this uninformed and often prejudicial society. So to me, the support means not only helping the individual understand these things, but helping to change the attitudes and understanding of society in order to make meaningful connection possible.
Yes, Scott, thank you. And we are short on time. Megan Farley, would you like to respond there?
Yeah, hallelujah. That's all I have to say. Scott is always the go-to person to hit the ball out of the park describing the experience and the needs. He's just terrific. I think he did a great job there.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us and shedding some light on this area. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Megan Farley is a psychologist and part of a research team studying aging and autism at the UW-Madison Weissman Center. Madeline Barger, therapist and lead behavior analyst with the Weissman Center Autism Treatment Programs. We continue this conversation ahead, exploring new ways to develop social environments for Wisconsin teens and young adults on the autism spectrum. And you can call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a new Wisconsin initiative for neurodivergent teens and young adults, creating arts-based activities and guided discussions in six communities through what's called the Fellowship. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Lofgren is a software engineer in Eau Claire and a participant in the Islands of Brilliance Fellowship Program. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And Kate Siekman here as well, Director of Learning and Outcomes for Islands of Brilliance. And this is a Milwaukee nonprofit offering learning experiences for children and young adults on the autism spectrum. Kate, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you co-wrote the curriculum for the fellowship. What, you know, how is this program designed? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this program was designed directly in response from young adults who we've met at various conferences within our communities in rural and mid-sized Wisconsin communities. And it was really developed as a space where young adults and teens entering their transition age years could really find partnership in each other, find community, and develop some really beautiful skills and art along with each other. So I wrote this program based on the positive youth development perspective, which really supports a strengths-based approach and a community-based approach, supporting citizenship and well-being of youth and young adults.
What is happening, as you call it, in those transition age years that could be better supported through different types of programs like art programming, for instance?
Right. So if we think about all of us as young adults, we all tended to gravitate toward folks who we related to, peers who we related to, who we could really ask those tough questions and live this experience together. And for a lot of autistic young adults, they don't always have that community of support and folks that they can rely on. So that's why we created this curriculum. And we're using art as a medium because over our 11 years of being around in the Milwaukee area, we found that art is that really great communicator. It doesn't require spoken word. It just requires that you engage fully and that you explore yourself through artistic expression.
Right. I mean, the focus is on what is something that is happening before you. Maybe your focus and your eyes are on something else, and yet you can still have a conversation with the person next to you who is also working on a similar project.
Absolutely. And really what we've found is that it really demands very little. In a world that has a lot of demands, all it asks is for you to be present and for you to express yourself. So it really gives a voice to folks who don't feel like they always have a voice.
Hmm. Chris, as a participant, what can you tell us? What is an example of a recent activity you did with the program?
Yeah, actually, just yesterday, they split us up into a couple different groups. One group essentially used physical mediums like pencil and paper, markers, and even sometimes googly eyes to create little cities. And then I believe the iPad group in the other section, they used Procreate on the organization issued iPads mm-hmm. to essentially draw superheroes. And then at the end, we all get together and kind of workshop each other's work like a gallery.
Who have you met at this program? Have you met new people?
Yeah, I'd say so. So some of the folks I recognize from other places across town. Sometimes people drive from further away, mm-hmm. but usually the fellowship participants are going to be local to the community where it's actually being hosted.
Does that make it special in some way, knowing that these are the people who are kind of your neighbors and they're around you in this in the larger community, and yet here you are sharing an activity with them?
Yeah, I'd say so, because for those folks who do share those common groups, it's obviously another avenue to explore a different way to create stuff together. And then for the folks who wouldn't have otherwise met me right? I'm able to kind of see what they're like and maybe learn more about them that way.
I wonder, how did you learn about the fellowship? How did you even discover its existence?
So this particular group has been cross-promoting with the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library.
Mm.
And I actually found out about it through their newsletter, among other places.
We're talking with Chris Lofgren, who is a fellowship participant in the Islands of Brilliance program. Kate Siekman co-wrote the curriculum as we look at this new arts programming. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Kate, do participants and fellows have to be formally diagnosed as neurodiverse?
Actually, no. And here's the reason behind that. Through our experience in working with autistic individuals and neurodiverse individuals as that umbrella term, we found some disparities in the diagnostic processes. So if you think about the disparities, I think about a couple of factors. Race being a disparity, it's seen that Black and brown individuals are less likely to be diagnosed formally with autism. We see a disparity in gender. So folks who are born female typically are not diagnosed until much later in life, if at all. And then socioeconomic status. So we see that folks who are lower income typically can't afford that diagnostic process. So because of those disparities, we don't require a formal diagnosis. We just require that folks identify as neurodiverse and are able to find that community in our programming.
For people who identify as neurodiverse or who do receive a diagnosis of autism in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s, even later, what effect might that have on their lives and their relationships and their social fabric? Can you talk further about that, Kate?
I can talk further based on the experiences that I've heard firsthand. But I would say that basically what they're experiencing is this disconnect in identity. So a lot of times when folks are diagnosed later in life, it's actually, I've heard from some that it's validating, because they had always felt like something was different and had a difficult time figuring out why that was. And for that reason, they didn't really receive services prior, those early intervention services or services to support them through their academic journey. So a lot of time those folks are feeling validated, but also lost. Now, what do I do with this diagnosis? What are my resources? So the resources tend to be a lot harder to obtain once you're older if you haven't had a diagnosis prior.
Chris, what do you think about a diagnosis and whether a person can diagnose themselves as neurodiverse and identifying as neurodiverse?
Kate, that's honestly a great question. I'm aware that, a lot of what Dr. Kate says is true. There aren't always a lot of resources available, especially if you live in smaller parts of the state where they just don't necessarily have the funds or resources available to devote to treating and helping neurodiverse folks. And even if those resources are there, I've heard horror stories from friends and other folks about how occasionally they've been even gaslit by the providers who are supposed to be giving them a fair evaluation, particularly because they may feel that because they saw it in a TikTok or something, that it's now some sort of trend to diagnose themselves as autistic or with ADHD or any kind of term under the neurodiverse umbrella.
Mm.
And I think that makes it incredibly difficult to be able to reach out to folks to get that diagnosis, because if you're already encountering that kind of stigma and you're getting it at the medical offices where you're supposed to be getting care, that can make it a lot harder when you finally receive that diagnosis, if you get it at all.
Mm.
And it's in working with that, the workplace isn't always accommodating of those kinds of differences.
It's not always supportive. Is that what you're saying as well?
Yeah. I've heard stories about how people I've worked with, even if they do have a formal ADHD diagnosis and they submit it to their workplace, HR, they don't get the proper care or accommodations that they would be entitled to, whether as a formality or under law. And it's led to them not doing as well as they otherwise could have done, or potentially even getting adversely affected in other ways.
Chris Lofgren is a software engineer and a poet in Eau Claire, participating in the local Islands of Brilliance Fellowship program. Kate Siegman is with us, Director of Learning and Outcomes for the Wisconsin organization Islands of Brilliance. You can call in with a question. You can share your perspective along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about a new statewide fellowship program. It's bringing together neurodivergent people in early adulthood through the arts, and it's led by the nonprofit Islands of Brilliance. And programs are underway in 6 Wisconsin communities. We heard from Paul in La Crosse, called in to share that they're an Islands of Brilliance participant, and they said they appreciate the inclusivity of the program. Call in with a question, add your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Lofgren is a software engineer and is participating in their local Islands of Brilliance Fellowship program. Kate Siegman is here, Director of Learning and Outcomes at Islands of Brilliance. Let's go to Eddie in Madison. Eddie, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can.
Oh, hi. My name is Edie.
Edie. I'm sorry.
I just wanted to give a shout-out to Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin in Dane County. I am a job coach, and I work for a supported employment program. I'm not sure if a lot of parents know, but we provide independence through the power of work. That's our mission, and we go to job sites and support people with disabilities. I have a lot of clients that have autism, and we support them in their work environment so that they're successful and social. And sometimes they even get to a point where they don't need our support other than checking in on them once in a while. But it's a pretty awesome program. And before I started working for Goodwill, I didn't realize we're not just buying used clothing. We're, you know, the money is used towards supported employment and independent living.
Edie, thank you so much for sharing that about a job coach and the impact at Goodwill. Kate, go ahead. What would you like to share about that and the impact of job coaches?
Yeah, so job coaching is a really important tool that some autistic folks may utilize within their communities. And it really does support the idea that folks with disabilities overall are entitled to employment and are entitled to a supported employment model. I will highlight that not all autistic individuals use job coaching, but I do know that that is a really valuable resource within our communities. So I appreciate Edie for sharing that with everyone.
Carissa, you were talking about a job site that is not supportive or hospitable. What impact do you think could job coaches have?
I think job coaches can be unique in that they could help place folks with positions that may be best suited to their individual needs and talents. I'm not aware of as much of an impact, positive or negative necessarily in the corporate world per se, but I would say that overall they are doing a pretty good service.
Kate, there are 6 fellowship programs operating in different regions of the state. Does each site operate in the same way, or do they have their own uniquenesses?
Oh, that's a really great question. I would say that the activities and the resources available to each site are equal across the board, but each site has such a unique group of folks and a unique culture into its own, which is what has been a really beautiful journey for me to go on through the process of leading this fellowship program, is seeing the cultures that have existed across our sites. While some sites have smaller groups, other sites have larger groups and lots of different subcultures that they have created, which is the best that I could have imagined for this program, really, because we know every community is unique in its own.
And Chris, you participate in the Eau Claire location, and I understand the Eau Claire location has a community of LGBTQ representation, maybe more so compared to other sites. What might be making this location a welcoming place?
I think Eau Claire, because of its positioning, both you know, right next to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, right there, mm-hmm. right? You have a lot of college folks coming in. And even just in general, Eau Claire seems to be one of the nicer communities as far as queer acceptance and whatnot. And so I think that for those reasons, maybe the concentration there of like queer folks versus people who might not identify as such is a bit stronger.
And you are a poet and a member of the local Queer Poetry Guild. How do you feel about expressing that side of yourself with other participants in the fellowship? Or have you offered your poetry through the fellowship?
I haven't offered it through the fellowship yet, mm-hmm. but I think poetry at large, as well as the stuff provided, you know, through the fellowship and other opportunities, is essentially a form of storytelling.
Yes.
And storytelling is a very, very strong skill to have in both personal and professional worlds. And I think it can really bring people together in a powerful way.
What impact has poetry had on your life?
I think it's enabled me to process some things, you know, personally that I haven't otherwise really thought through. Because taking experiences and putting them into words or art or other things, that's something that can take time and effort, and sometimes it does bring about uncomfortable feelings that you have to like interrogate to kind of figure out why it is that they are that way. But if you're comfortable doing that, I think it's a pretty strong way to do that in combination or sometimes in lieu of professional therapy and other things like that.
Chris Lofgren, there is a fellowship participant in Islands of Brilliance as we talk about this new arts program. The program co-written by Kate Siekman, and you can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Carrie in Shorewood is here. Carrie, hello. Hi,
good
Carrie.
Morning.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, I just wanted to say I have a nephew in his early 30s on the spectrum, and I didn't know if there was any resource people out there to help with navigating dating and, you know, with texting, with setting up, you know, first dates and things like that. I've watched that show, Love on the Spectrum, it's called, and I've seen that even there was someone that could guide these people with that. Is there anybody like that in Wisconsin?
Carrie, thank you for the call. Kate, did you hear that Carrie is talking about someone in their network in their early 30s and really guiding through that relationship process of forming relationships and intimate partners?
That's a really good question. And as I listened to your previous, the previous guests that you had on the show, I know that there are a lot of therapists who take on that topic, but I also have to say there is something to having a supportive network of peers who align with a lot of similar life experiences to help with that navigating the dating world. Our program, Islands of Brilliance, does offer a young adult program where they meet. We meet virtually every Friday, and then once a month we go out into the community and participate in really just fun leisure activities. We share a meal, but a lot of our participants in their 20s and 30s have found a community in our Brilliant Breakfast Club program and have found a really supportive network of peers. In addition, some folks find that it's helpful to talk to a therapist who specializes in neurodiversity and relationships. I happen to know there's a therapist out of Madison via an organization called Heart Consulting that does a really phenomenal job and is actually running a free virtual workshop here in March regarding the same topic on relationships and dating for folks who are neurodiverse.
Okay, thank you so much for that insight. Kristen, just final moments together. I'm wondering if there's anything you would like to further expand on about the fellowship and about Islands of Brilliance.
Yeah, so from what I've heard, it's mostly a weekly gathering. Sometimes that can change for different reasons, but overall, I think it's a really great way to connect with folks. Both who you might know and who you might not otherwise have known about.
Yeah.
And just kind of create art together.
Oh,
you know,
I love
tell
that.
Stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Chris, Kate, thank you for joining us.
Thanks
for having us.
Kate Siekman, Director of Learning and Outcomes for Islands of Brilliance. Chris Lofgren is a software engineer and a poet in Eau Claire participating in their local Islands of Brilliance Fellowship Program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.